Welcome to Tuesday Topics. At the beginning of Tuesday Topics this evening, I, Paul Edwards, was not actually there. My computer was not behaving very well, and therefore I didn't in fact arrive until about halfway through the session, or perhaps even further along. Nevertheless, Tuesday Topics did happen. I'd like to thank Rachel for her work in recording, and obviously Dave Williams and George Vise for their work in editing and making iVocalize available to ACB. In addition, I'd like to thank Brian Charlson, who at the last minute came in and co-hosted Tuesday Topics with me this evening. And it was decided that rather than discuss the issue of commissions for the blind, the group that was here felt more comfortable talking about some of the ways that blind people perceive visual things. And so to tell you what sparked this idea, it gives me great pleasure to introduce Brian Charlson.
Okay, the topic that we've agreed to discuss this evening is how blind people perceive what other people might consider to be totally visual information. What brought this to mind is an article I recently read in the Boston Globe, and I'm sure that it was one of those articles that was reprinted around the country, about a Turkish gentleman who, blind since birth, with about 51 years of age, he was educated, as they say in Turkey, in the streets. He does not have a formal education. And during his childhood, the only thing he really was very good at was scratching out pictures, if you will, in the dirt with a stick. Eventually, he graduated to pencils and pens and paper and watercolor paints. And most recently, he discovered quick-drying acrylic paints. So he's broadened his medium quite a bit. The concept that this gentleman is able to draw items in perspective, for example, drawing a road that leads from near the viewer into the distance and show the proper perspective, how things seem to appear smaller and smaller the farther away they get, and they might even seem to tilt in a particular direction depending on the angle of view. He also can shade them in as if he knew how sunlight would be blocked by and other or reflected by objects. And the whole concept of blending colors so that he could actually paint a tree trunk as being more than just a stick of brown, as one might expect bark to be, but with many other colors within it that create a bark-like effect. So a number of people are coming and going here, so as my computer talks, because I don't have a headset, you may hear some of that in the background, and I apologize in advance. Does anybody here know of any person in their immediate experience who seemed to have this kind of ability to perceive things that you would expect only a sighted person or a person who is seen most of their life to comprehend?
Gary Wood from Lansing, Michigan. And I've heard about on ACB radio, there's a guy in Holland, I guess, or Dutchman, devised the method of seeing with sound, you know, seeingwithsound.org is where you can go for that. But they use a way of connecting a camera, computer, well, you know, one of those laptop computers with a camera and headset, and you hear the rising tones that convey the height of the color of an object, and the lower tones, and it goes, you know, the lower part of the object, like it goes left to right, top to bottom, like we see, you know, you use stereo. But then the rising tones and the falling tones, and then the brighter it is, the louder it is, and the darker it is, the farther away it is. But some people say that reading Braille enhances your visual ability of the brain. So, it helps your visual part of your brain or something like that. If you can read Braille, but I don't know if that tells anybody anything.
You got a good point, Gary. In fact, the reason this gentleman came here to Boston to have his brain scanned is because Boston had already been engaged. One of our hospitals, Brigham and Women's Hospital, had already engaged itself in taking individuals who were blind, placing them in an MRI machine, and having them run their fingertips across Braille and mapping the blood flow in the brain while that was going on. And one of the things they discovered in that is those who are Braille readers utilize portions of their visual cortex, the part of the brain that is usually used to process visual images, to that becomes involved in their brain as they're reading Braille. So this gentleman, they wanted to see if a similar thing was taking place, and in fact it certainly was, probably even more so than those of us reading Braille with our hands. If this gentleman was in the chamber and wasn't drawing, his brain reacted one way, and when he was drawing and imagining how he wanted the lines to be and the colors to be as he was drawing it, it showed an extreme amount of blood flow in his visual cortex. So it's being remapped, in his case at least, by this indicator at least, to expand his ability to visualize, even though he's never seen in the first place. The other thing, of course, in all of this is the brain, like other parts of the body, there's some question as to how, what they call, plastic it is. That is, how much it's able to remap itself. I know as I grew up, we all assumed that whenever a brain cell died, one was not created to take its place. At least that was one of my basic beliefs through education. It's been proven, however, here in the past decade or so, that you in fact do replace brain cells over time, and that brain cells can be retrained to do some pretty remarkable things. When one part of the brain gets damaged, another part of the brain steps in to try to pick up some of that change. We've heard about this through brain injury kind of activities over time. Also, those persons who have epilepsy and other kinds of damage to the brain, when they remove the scar tissue, some pretty miraculous things can take place. Memories rediscovered, things along those lines. So I wouldn't be at all surprised to find that some individuals have the ability to utilize their visual cortex in this kind of way without necessarily ever having seen before. What I find interesting, however, is thinking about whether or not that kind of thing can in fact be taught, or whether it's something that's inherent in the biology of the individual.
I wonder if it has something to do with the brain's ability to use the visual cortex in a unique way to people who are blind and visually impaired. I wonder if that has something to do with the cause of blindness. I have optic nerve hypoplasia, which means that my optic nerves never really developed, and so I wonder if that really affects my visual cortex, because my view of the world and how I visualize things is very tactile. When I visualize something in my mind, it always has to do with how it feels under my hand. When I think of a car or an airplane or a bird or anything, I think about statues or models or toys that I've seen and played with, and I don't really feel that I have a truly good visual grasp, of how everyday things look. My own grasp of it seems to enable me to live pretty well in the world. I mean, I'm independent and do as I like and travel as I like and all of that. So it hasn't negatively impacted my ability to live as an independent blind person, but I surely don't believe that I have a visual view of the world, especially when it comes to huge objects where you're just looking at a little piece of it at a time. I've always found it easier to take a little version of it in my hand and get a grasp of what it looks like tactually. In other words, looking at a little toy statue of a horse instead of trying to get a visual grasp of what a horse looks like by seeing a full-grown stallion or mare or something like that. Although I get help with my tactual view on how it feels and how it smells and how it acts when I'm around and that kind of a thing. But in terms of just how it looks, I do better by looking at small things, and my view of the world is pretty tactile, I think. When I envision something in my mind, it's how it appears to me. So I would never be able to draw with the finesse that this gentleman has. And visualizing horizons, intellectually, I know what a horizon is, but I don't have any real picture in my mind of visualizing what a horizon is and how a road looks as you look down the road, how it is impacted by the horizon and by the visual field as part of the road gets farther and further away. I guess the closest understanding I have to it is when you hear trains in movies and the little bell is ringing and, you know, it goes ding, 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 and as the train is supposed to be moving farther and farther away, the bell goes ding, 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 ding. And I guess that's the closest understanding that I have of horizon. So I think this is miraculous, and I do wonder if the cause of blindness has something to do with our ability either to view the world visually or not view the world visually.
This is Rachel, and the other thing I was thinking about kind of along those same lines is you're talking about a situation where there were some things that he might have known kind of more in a three-dimensional sense, and to be able to take that picture, rather that 3D image, and be able to transform that into basically a two-dimensional image, as in a picture or a drawing, that to me, you know, I've never seen, and to think about that, how something that we only know tactily as a 3D something can two-dimensionally look the same or look as if it would be the same object. I don't know if that makes sense, but there's that try anyway.
While we think of this on kind of an academic way right now, the fact is that this does impact the lives of blind people, this ability to perceive or not to perceive something. Recently, my wife, Kim, was reviewing a question in our state required tests for school children. This had to deal with geometry. And she was shown a question that described a pyramid having a four-sided bottom, a square bottom, and tapered to a central point at a 10-degree angle. Tell the instructor how tall that pyramid is. So they gave you the length of 14 centimeters for each side of the square base and told you the angle and said, how tall is it? For the sighted student, there was a diagram of the pyramid, and the question was, could we render this diagram tactually in a way that would work for a blind person to see or comprehend its three-dimensional nature, or ought we to actually provide a tactile pyramid, a 3D pyramid to put in their hands for them to understand this? And there are certainly some of us who have seen in the past that comprehend this idea of how you can draw a three-dimensional image on only two dimensions, height and width, by using shading and by distorting, if you will, the farther away objects of the picture compared to those that are nearer by. So my question would be, you know, here is a situation where knowing it or not knowing it, being able to perceive it as a picture and imagine it in your mind's eye, whether you've seen or not before, really will control what kind of score you're going to get in this test and whether you're going to pass or not the basic competency in Massachusetts schools.
Well, I don't know. Then maybe it might say a lot to whether maybe blind children should have a visual training in school, learning how to visualize things and learn how to. I mean, I think that maybe as far as blind people getting on in the world, I suppose it's important to be able to think of things in a visual standpoint, because I suppose maybe how we relate to sighted people maybe has a lot to do with how we can I mean, this probably goes back to some of the stuff about relationships that we've talked about in the past, but I suppose how we relate to people has to do with how we can perceive things in a visual way like they do, but since never having seen it. Like, I was born blind, and my right eye is an artificial, but I had a detached retina. The right eye was removed, and the left eye is a scar tissue on the optic nerve thing. But does that say that maybe we should, for the children growing up today, should they have some visual education on how the world works, you know, so that they get some idea?
Well, I'm not sure, unless it comes naturally to one, as it obviously does to this gentleman, that you can teach a child something that a visual perception of the world when the child doesn't, for the most part, have the tools to see it. When Brian was talking about the pyramid, I visualized a tactile pyramid that I had actually seen, and that's what I thought of. And I didn't view it in any way visually. An idea of it came up in my mind as to how it felt. I remembered the material that it was made of and what it looked like and about how big it was, but it was all very tactile. And that's why I still wonder if the cause of someone's visual impairment plays a role in one's ability to have this visual ability or not.
I would think, Debbie, that if the cause of your visual impairment is ROP or RLF, depending on what generation you learned about it, since that had to do with over-oxygenating the visual system, I'm not sure if that extends into the visual cortex or not, but I've always suspected that in some cases it certainly did. Some of the people that I've seen that have a real difficult time with navigation are more likely to be ROP folk than not ROP folk. Clearly there are exceptions to that, but I think that statistically speaking, it's a pretty accurate statement. So under those circumstances, I do think that the cause of blindness has to have had some effect on this. Certainly the time that blindness happens has an effect on your ability. Do any of you know about the story of Michael May?
One of my dearest friends is really close to him, and I've heard about his story and how he now can see. Is it out of one eye now?
He's had a corneal... Well, first off, Michael was blinded at about the age of 11 in a chemical explosion, not dissimilar to myself, blinded at the age of 11, but in Michael's case, the fluid was very acidic, and so it burned the surfaces of his eyes badly enough that no surgery at that time could restore his vision. But a few years back, he had both corneal transplants and, as I understood it, some T-cell transplants as well that allowed him to regain a significant amount of vision, strictly as a matter of the visual system and changes to the eyeball itself. It's my understanding also, however, that he continues to struggle in taking the images that he sees and comprehending them. For example, I kind of read his journal. He was keeping an online journal that you could access on a website. So I was reading it from time to time, and he was asking about things. And Debbie, what brought this to mind was your discussion of horizons. He was on a bus, a Greyhound bus headed somewhere, and he asked somebody what that was out there. Was that, you know, smog or something? He said, no, that's the horizon. So now he knows what a horizon looks like, but he still has a difficult time mentally comprehending what it is he's seeing that causes a horizon to exist. I know that when he looks at a picture of an object, a photograph of an object, and then sees that object in 3D, he really can't comprehend that 3D object unless he also adds the sense of touch to that object. And it's very similar to the language centers of the brain, where if you're not taught how to talk at an early age, it's almost impossible to teach you to talk at a later age.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. But the only thing I know about horizons is it's far, far away, but I don't know. Like when Ryan was mentioning about the pyramid, I can see, I haven't seen one in a while, but a pyramid is smaller at the top than it is at the bottom, but I don't know, this guy, I mean, it's quite amazing. I mean, it's quite a difference between someone who's been born blind, never been able to see, and then those who could see and then lose the ability to see later on in life.
I'm curious about people's experience with using raised line drawings, things like raised line maps, and then being able to apply it in an effective way in doing personal navigation. If somebody drew you a map of the layout of a 10-block area where there were streets that curved and streets that came at right angles to one another, those that were dead ends or T-intersections and the like, does it help you to feel a raised line drawing of that area prior to you going out and exploring that area in real life or not?
This is Rachel. See, maps for me are okay. There again, it's that two-dimensional thing. You know, I look at a map and I see a smaller version of the area that I'm going to be traveling.
When I was in school, grade school and high school, at the Florida School of the Blind, they had these wooden little boards that they had streets and stuff drawn on in the mobility office that we had to kind of trace out and follow. Rachel's on the Velcro mats. I remember that too. But yeah, we'd do that, and I would show the area around the campus and the surrounding areas, and I could follow that pretty well. I didn't seem to have a problem with that. By the way, this is Larry Turnbull in Orlando, Florida.
I find maps an aid, but I really like having a verbal explanation as well. It really helps me. And what I like best is actually going on the route and actually getting that view of it, however my mind operates on that view. So a map is an aid, but I don't feel that a map gives me all the information that I need. I like a verbal description to go along with the map. You know, when you get down here, you're going to see this, and then you're going to start angling over here. And when I have that visual help along with the map, it seems to go much better for me than just the flat map.
I know for me, a map, although I said I could kind of figure it out, yes, the basics I could figure out. You know, you go several blocks, and like you were saying, Brian, but it's still not the same as traveling the route. And it, Debbie's right, it is basically an aid, and finding a shortcut wouldn't be a problem. But there again, you might be dealing with some spatial issues that may not be represented as well on the map.
You know, I totally agree with what Rachel had to say. The problem that I have had with maps is that I imagine something in my head by looking at the map, but many times the route doesn't resemble that when I actually get out and do it. Spaces are much larger. It takes longer to get from point A to point B than my visualizing this flat map. What I can do in terms of shortcuts and finding other places along a route that I've been is, if I've walked it, then I can visit, and I've walked someplace else on a route, I can take that information and kind of add it together and work off of it and learn to find other places. Having street names is really helpful to me, and I was just asking my husband, Freela, who's an excellent traveler, he does much better than I do on learning stuff from maps and figuring out routes right off the bat without having walked them. I do much better if I've actually done it, and then I'm pretty adventurous and can manage. But I don't know how good I'd be at figuring out those shortcuts and well, you know, if you take this street, you can get to Burger King over here, even though this was originally the route that you were going to take to get to the bank. I can do that once I've walked it. I don't know how good I'd be at doing that on a map.
I'm curious. Were those who are blind since birth, who are here with us this evening, were any of you taught the concept of shade, shadow, that kind of thing in any kind of formal way that you remember?
I don't know. I think I think for some reason part of you is cutting out the... Were we taught the concept of what now?
Shadow. The idea that when an object is... an object can block light and what effect that would have in the background.
I was taught about shadows and that, you know, that kids played with their shadows and that kind of thing. But Brian, and I think intellectually I knew that shadows changed the light and that kind of thing. I think it was explained to me so that I had some kind of intellectual understanding of it. But once again, because I couldn't touch a shadow, I don't think I have a total understanding other than this intellectual understanding of what a shadow is and why it appears and why it works like it does and that kind of thing that you learn in basic seventh grade science or whatever grade it happened to be. I don't think I have a true visual understanding of a shadow, and I was born blind.
I used to have sight for about the first 7-8 years of my life, and I used to play with shadows. I remember usually when it's bright and sunny, and usually around noon or 1 o'clock or so, the shadows aren't very big. But as you know, the light dims towards evening, the shadows do tend to get bigger. And I remember playing with shadows on the wall where light would be shining on the wall, and I would approach it, and I'd see my shadow, and then I'd back away from it, and it looks like my shadow would grow or be almost to the ceiling. You know, I used to think that was kind of cool and all that.
Well, maybe, I don't know, from the feel of the sun, I know you're facing the sun, and if you turn your back away from the sun, then you would be in the dark area. I mean, that would be your shadow would be behind you if you're facing the sun, and then... And in front of you, if your back is toward the sun, kind of no fun.
A shadow is any time you block light with an object. Not when you're looking at the object, but when you look at where the light would have fallen against other surfaces had it not been blocked. So certainly when a person's walking down the street at 8 in the morning and the sun's just over the horizon and shining at you, if you're walking toward the sun, there's going to be a shadow behind you, and a shadow and shade is really the same thing. When we think of shade, though, we think that it's been there a while, and it creates a cooling effect as much as it creates a light effect. Would you say that's an accurate statement?
Oh, yeah, I understand that. And I noticed that in a way you could say that there's a sound shadow. Like if you were listening to a book or something and you're sitting back several feet away from the speakers and then somebody goes in front of you, that creates a shadow, so to speak, you know. Because it blocks the sound a little bit.
I used to ride my bike and really go all over the place, you know, that was safe anyway, just on shadows, either sound shadows, if you will, or some of the visual kind of shadows. I have ROP, and I can see light and shadows. And I used to do the same thing with the sun, although I couldn't get into as much detail as what Larry was saying, where you could see the shadow get bigger or whatever, but I could see that the shadow was there, and you know, that's about the extent of my real visual kind of ability, I guess.
So shadow is one of those things which we may have experienced as a matter of heat and cool. Shadow is something we may have been academically taught or was part of our culture as we were growing up, especially if we were growing up around people with sight. And it may be a strong memory for those of us who have lost our sight, because it has quite a striking visual effect on things, especially when you can notice the distortion of the shape, because it doesn't cast an exact image of the thing that's casting the shadow or blocking the sun, that has the tendency to leak around the corners and get a little fuzzy around the edges. And of course, depending on the angle, it may cause your image to seem, your shadow to be bigger than you are, which is a hard concept, I think, to really comprehend academically. I'm also curious about what people perceive of color. When you were taught color as a totally blind person, how did they go about doing that?
I guess I was taught pretty much, when I think of blue, I think of cold, or when I think of red, I think of hot. And something like when something is white, I mean, like sometimes when something is white, you think of something cold, like the snow is white underfoot, and then, but generally you do think of blue as being color, and I don't know. I've heard people say black is the absence of color, but then I've heard other people say white is, but white is kind of a transparent thing, I guess. But well, it's all full color, I guess. someone said that the color of the rainbow actually a white. But then black is what we see when we don't see anything, I guess. But since we don't see anything, we don't really know what the color black is, I would think.
See, I think there still has to be another association there. It just doesn't work for me that somebody can say blue is cool. I think the association, there's got to be something in the middle that says such and such is cool and it's blue. And then you kind of, therefore, blue is cool. It just, I can't make that association. But the way I was kind of taught color there again was because I was able to see light contrasts, was different colored lights, and I knew that, and like the yellow light tended to be kind of brighter than another color. And also with different colored paper, which would be kind of put against a light background, and I would kind of use almost the shadows, if you will, of that, the lightness or darkness of the shadow kind of to determine. I couldn't really distinguish between, say, a dark blue and a black, but maybe like a yellow and a red or something, they would look different, you know, something like that.
That's one of the things I had a hard time explaining to anybody that's been blind since birth, because, of course, I used to see and I could see colors. I don't know how to explain it to someone. I envy anyone who can. I remember my scientific theory from the days of old. White is the presence of all colors. Black is the absence. Black absorbs heat, and white reflects it. That's pretty much how that goes.
I think that clearly over a lifetime, you start to associate certain things with certain colors. I was talking to a friend of mine who happens to be Turkish the other day during the Super Bowl about this Turkish gentleman we started this conversation with. And he said, clearly, a person who is blind has to accept some concepts on faith. And color is one of those things that you accept on faith. It clearly exists because people who have vision constantly perceive it, and it plays an important part in their decision making, etc. What am I going to wear today? Well, I feel more like wearing the blue dress than the red one, or whatever. So it's part of their lives in a very fundamental kind of way. And for us, for the most part, it's an academic kind of understanding.
I have very little understanding of color. I think one of the most frustrating things to me growing up was the idea of pictures. And that applies, by the way, just as much to tactile drawings as it does to drawn pictures. I remember at the age of 8 looking at the Boy Scout handbook produced by the Royal National Institute for the Blind in the UK. And they had pictures of all sorts of animals in the very first volume because they wanted to show you what your troop was, the wolf and the bear and all these sorts of things. And they not only made no sense to me, they were counterintuitive, because here you have flat drawings that allege to have four legs. I'm sorry, it makes no sense. A flat drawing doesn't have four legs, and what these seem to have were protuberances that sort of pointed downwards at each end, but for the most part, it looked like there was only one at each end and not two. So for my whole life, I have been frustrated by my inability to comprehend such things as pictures and perspective. But the truth is, I suppose, that I really haven't been very frustrated, because I've essentially decided after some thought, the heck with this mess, what does it matter? Interestingly enough, and I'll shut up after this, I remember looking at some tactile drawings with my friend Brian Charlson from Massachusetts, who actually was able to see at 11 but has absolutely no vision now. And in about 90 or 95% of the cases, Brian was able to identify tactile drawings perfectly, whereas to me, they were not only Greek, but they were Greek written backwards with Chinese characters.
There's an association that we're just missing. You know, you go from, say, point A to point B, but all the points in between we're missing. So we can't associate that flat picture with something that's three-dimensional. It just doesn't happen.
That's why when I was talking about my view of the world being pretty tactile when it came to imagining things, and I talked about that horse, when I talked about viewing a horse and realizing what one looked like because I could hold one in my hand, it was an actual four-dimensional object that I could, with all of its dimensions in play, that I could actually feel and see how its legs were connected to it and its tail and its ears and its head. And then when I saw a real horse, I, as I had said earlier, got the view of what it smelled like and what it sounded like and what it felt like and all of that. And so all of the dimensions were kind of there for me. But my view of the world is definitely tactile, and I don't have any visual view in mind when I think of anything, really.
Well, I think that's the way I look at it too, because like yourself, I've never having seen that. I kind of look at things more tactily than otherwise, you know.
I think that Brian and I would disagree, Gary, on your question, because we've actually talked about it before, but I'm going to ask Brian to jump in first. Gary's question, Brian, was should we educate blind children so that they understand the visual world, and should we encourage them, if not push pretty hard, that they come to terms with tactile drawings? Your view, sir?
I think it is an absolute travesty that it is not part of a core curriculum.
Yeah. And in a minute, I'm going to ask you to provide us with some reasons why that's true. But I'm going to start by playing the devil's advocate and suggesting to you that for many blind people, it really doesn't matter how many times you show us tactile drawings. It really doesn't matter how many times you show us maps. Well, maps are a little different because you can see some relationship of things. But for the most part, it doesn't really matter how many times you show those of us who are congenitally blind and totally blind these things. They're not going to mean anything to us, and we're not going to care, and it's not going to make very much difference in terms of how we perceive things. Why should it be a part of the core curriculum, and what should be taught, and what would you expect the outcomes to be?
Several things. First off, I think it needs to be taught, because much of what living in a sighted society is all about are decisions we make based on issues such as color, and also many of the ways that we allow ourselves experiences beyond what we can reach out and touch is through picture. So by saying, well, I simply don't understand those pictures, I don't think I should have to understand those pictures, therefore I can ignore those pictures, is saying there's this vast way of experiencing the world if I only took the time to do it. But you know, I choose not to take the time to understand the world at all in that way. So it's like being able to learn from somebody else's experience, being able to learn from pictures of things. Think about armchair travelers who can sit and watch a documentary on a country and feel, and with some justification, that they have an understanding of that country beyond what they could just read in a book. Pictures worth 1,000 words, and I think that's not a far-fetched idea. It's not just a nice little phrase. There's a lot of truth to it. If we taught children early on some of these concepts, I think that they could apply it to very practical things as well. For example, learning to use Windows. Certainly there are people who know how to use the Windows operating system who don't think of it in a visual way. But I can assure you that many individuals understand and learn Windows more quickly because they grasp the visual metaphor that is Windows. And this is not just something for the blind either, in my opinion. Stop and think about many of the scientific instruments that are used. For example, radio astronomy. They render something that is non-visual visual so that they can observe it and utilize that information to both learn and to build ideas You certainly could not see microbes without a microscope. So we use devices to make things that are too small, large enough to see, too far away, large enough to see, to change some things from electrical impulses into audio sounds in order for us to perceive them. And I think that for us to turn our back on the idea that a tactile image shouldn't be an important part of how we convert something that we can't be there to experience into something that we can be close enough to get a fairly good idea of, I think is an unfortunate belief.
I would say, as far as windows, though, when you're talking about windows, describing them visually will allow you to know where things are on the screen.
Debbie, can I draw you into this for a moment? I want you to bring back that idea you had of looking at a figurine of a horse. When you set that horse down, when you use that figurine, did it make you better understand the horse when you touched the whole object?
I think it did, because as I said, when I would look at something very huge, I could visualize what I was touching at the moment, but I had a really hard time getting a full picture of that thing. It's the same thing as the Statue of Liberty. I went to New York City, and I climbed inside the Statue of Liberty and did all those things that everybody does, especially when they've seen the Statue of Liberty for the first time, but I really didn't have an understanding of what the Statue of Liberty looked like till I bought a little replica for a paperweight from the Statue of Liberty gift shop, and I went, oh, you know, because I could see the crown on top of the head and the torch in the hand and how the base looked and how it was mounted on the base and how its arm was up and all those things, and I didn't get a view of that from hearing about or even trying to touch the big thing, and the same thing with the horse. I guess what I'd say about trying to teach people visual things is that I don't know how, from my own perspective, I don't know how you do it if you don't do it tactily.
Hi, everybody. This is Anisio. I couldn't agree more with what you just said, Debbie. I think I lost my vision on all three. A lot of what my learning has been through touch and hearing and experiential. And Brian, although intellectually I can see where you're coming from, I think there's a danger of assuming that perhaps someone who has a different mental picture or a different way of arriving at a mental picture that is not visual, that somehow is missing something. And I think that's a slippery walk, I think, to take for me.
Mr. Brian, I think that you're bringing up the horse with something of a Trojan activity, because the horse is a three-dimensional object, and I don't think that anybody here is suggesting there isn't an immense amount of value in terms of giving blind individuals an opportunity to see things in three dimensions. And I'll go further. I will say that I think it's absolutely appropriate to show blind folks maps and graphs, which, if you exclude the notion of a physical map, are for the most part intended to show relationships on a single plane. And those are perfectly comprehensible to a person who's blind, and can and should be taught. The same thing's true of shapes like squares, triangles, and so on. Those all can be taught. The difficulty is when you try to take a look at three-dimensional objects in two dimensions. When I couldn't comprehend things that my sighted teachers thought I should, when I really didn't get diagrams, I was made to feel pretty inferior and pretty incompetent. And I think that it did some damage to my self-esteem in terms of a fairly good, bright student who is suddenly being told, well, if you're a good, bright student, you ought to be able to understand what I tell you about perspective. You ought to be able to comprehend a three-dimensional object in two dimensions. And if you can't, I mean, it's obvious that there's something seriously wrong with you, or that was the implication. So, Brian, you certainly had some responses to your suggestions. Let me give you a chance to rebut and then see who else wants to jump in.
I'm not so much going to rebut as conclude my so to speak, argument, and that is, if we take the picture or the figurine of Debbie's horse, and you were to cut it in half lengthwise from nose to tail tip, and then turn it so that the side that's facing you is that flat side, you've just created a horse in silhouette. You've rendered a three-dimensional object into two dimensions. Yes, through the application of lines, etc., on that flat surface that's the silhouette of the horse, you add additional information. But again, if you can imagine taking three-dimensional objects and slicing them in this fashion, you can get a general idea of how a three-dimensional object can be rendered in two dimensions with a bit of extra shading here and there to give it what they call depth. There's some real value in having some of that if you're going to engage in the sciences of any kind, or at least almost any kind, and if you're going to engage, I think, in learning things vicariously. This could be a real valuable tool for you. I agree. One of the biggest problems in trying to teach something like this is there are going to be individuals who pick it up and individuals who don't, and you can't misunderstand the nature of what you're doing into thinking that makes one smart and one less smart. Is a person who is tone deaf and can't sing a tune somehow or other less of a human being than an individual who can hear melody and appreciate melody and perhaps has perfect pitch? I would suggest to you, no, it's not better or worse. It's different. But it doesn't mean that you ought to simply say that all music is null and void and you shouldn't have any understanding of the concept of music, in as much as it affects everybody's, virtually everybody's days of life, and also the culture they live in.
Brian, I'm not going to let you off the hook quite yet, because I want you to either reaffirm or step back from your original claim. You indicated that if you slice a horse down the center from its nose to its tail, and you look at the flat side, and you in effect, let's say, leave nothing but that flat side visible on a surface, you have the picture of the silhouette of a horse. I find that so difficult to believe, because in the first place, in effect, if I'm understanding what you're saying, you've only got two of the horse's legs left, and you're also building that silhouette in effect from the inside rather than from the outside, so that what you would actually see is perhaps an outline, but not a full silhouette, not a clear picture of the shadowed whole horse. You're just seeing, in effect, the outline of a two-legged horse.
You are seeing the outline of a horse, but not necessarily two-legged. If the legs of the horse were positioned in such a way that the legs closest to you, the viewer, were occluding in their entirety the legs farthest away from you, the viewer, you would have in silhouette what looks to be a two-legged horse. Absolutely right. Most artistic drawings of horses have the horses where the hind legs, those legs that are farthest away from you in silhouette, are moved forward. So because of the concept of perspective, they look like they're in fact shorter than the other legs, and you'd think the whole damn thing would topple over. So there's clearly has to be a component in all of this of faith. We know that those legs that are shorter are the legs that are farther away from the viewer, and that's why they're shorter. They're not literally shorter on that biological horse. They're only shorter by perspective. But again, the silhouette remains the silhouette. Imagine a horse. Well, you can't. Imagine a horse standing on the horizon in silhouette. That's what you would see. As if the horse were sliced in half, nose to tail, and perhaps you see the back image of the distant legs shortened and at an angle.
Goodness,
Let me see if people have final comments on this subject. One of the things that I would love to have gotten into, we didn't this time, is how people dream, because I think that's sort of a cool question. And it's one that sighted people always seem to ask blind folks, too. It's a kind of a cool question. But does anybody, maybe another topic, does anybody have some final comments on this topic? And by the way, thank you very much, Brian, and all of you for pinch hitting while I attempted to heal my sick access technology here.
Well, I think that this has been quite an education about how we visualize things, and I kind of appreciate being a part of this tonight. And I think that the thing about these Tuesday topics, I think it offers up a roadmap to the future as to where we go from here. I mean, it's not so much where we've been, but how we get to where we're going from where we are.
Well, I think this has been an interesting discussion because it's obvious that either consciously or subconsciously, all of us have given this issue of a visual feel for the world in which we live and the concepts that are in this world, we have all given it a great deal of thought. If we hadn't, we wouldn't have this show. And I think we all care about it, and I think we want to be as included in the sighted world and have as much of an understanding of the world of the visual as we possibly can. But as I was talking last week when we were talking about body language in terms of relationships and communicating with people and that kind of thing, and I drew the parallel of a person who is deaf who has been taught to talk but who has never heard language, who has not heard the ebb and flow of the voice, of the rise and fall, of how the syllables and the words fall together and that kind of thing. The person sounds different to us when we hear her speak. If any of you ever had the opportunity to hear Helen Keller speak, as brilliant as this woman was, her speech was very different from ours, even though she tried to speak. And I think the same thing happens to us in terms of this visual world.
Just in summary, I honestly don't have a whole lot of time for all this, I must say. I think we can get the same types of information or end up at the same end marker with the same information, just using different channels. And I think I wouldn't waste my time on trying to understand how others get there, because I certainly can't do that. I use a different way. And we should not forget, too, that pictures can be very subjective. So it's not like the visual sense is this very accurate, information-laden type of sense. When, and especially when you talk about impressions or colors, or, you know, you ask three different people and you get three different opinions about what that means to them.
Well, in spite of the fact that our original intent was to get together and talk about agencies, I found that this topic that virtually everybody in the room could personally relate to this, I think that's a good thing. We didn't have an expert on it. Instead, we all were bringing our life's experiences to the topic, and I think that that was good. I think we had virtual 100% participation in this evening's topic, a good thing for Tuesday Topics and for ACB Radio. I think it's a good thing for individuals to be able to take any tools that they can latch on to help better understand the world around them. If you can do it, I think it's worth doing. If you can't do it as a result of lack of life experience or biological, we were talking about whether or not some of this is built into our biology, our heredity, our ability to do these things or not do these things, that it's certainly worth exploring. In the same way that I wouldn't encourage anybody to suggest that those without the sense of smell aren't missing out on something, I think they would be, fresh bread or whatever. And if there was a way for them to comprehend it, or at least to gain what information is available in that fashion, it seems to me an exercise well worth going through, and I appreciate everybody's participation.
For those of you expecting to hear about agencies, you'll just have to visualize them at some other time. I'd like to thank the folks in Orlando, in particular Rachel, for recording our program tonight, Dave Williams for the editing that turns our rambles into a comprehensible ACB radio program, And of course, I'd like to thank George Vise and Talking Communities for making this technology available to ACB. Next week on Tuesday Topics, we may actually get back to talking about agencies and commissions for the blind. And we may not. It will depend on what people decide they want to do after our program this evening. In the meantime, thank you very much for listening, everyone. On behalf of Tuesday Topics and all of our participants, good night. Next week on Tuesday Topics, we will actually get to our discussion of how agencies for the blind are organized. How are they governed? How does the way they're governed affect the way that they perform? How do agencies in this country differ from agencies in others? And what's the relationship between the federal government and state agencies that are out there? And indeed, the relationship between state agencies and private agencies that provide services for the blind. It's a complex subject, but it's one that we hope you'll join us for on Tuesday Topics.